I'm going to read, so it can be a bit boring. But well, the general idea is to talk about the practices of keeping the body remains to venerate or to worship in Buddhist context. And so, like in general, in the Buddhist world, even in the old day, you have like a burial mound which contain kind of bits of cremated bones, and then they believed that those cremated bones belong to the bodies of the Buddha, and so, you know, hence they are considered as relics. Yeah. So, well, I'm sorry, just to let you know that this is a topic called corporeal relics in Kantaran stupas, and so, but not every stupas or not every burial mound contain bits of cremated bones. I mean, they were supposed to contain remains of the deceased, and then in the Buddhist world, they believe that those human remains belong to the Buddha. Even now, well, let's say nowadays, but then back in time, in about 2,000 years ago, we don't really know what the bits of bone, I mean, to whom the bits of bone belonged. But we've got some containers, as in, like, for example, like that, reliquaries. Some of them were inscribed as containing the relics or the bones of the Buddha, as in the historical Buddha himself, whereas other stupas do not contain anything at all, or whereas some stupas do not contain bones, but instead contain something else. So this is just the general idea that I'm going to look at the broad overview of, you know, the pattern of stupas in Kantara, which is the modern day North Pakistan and East Afghanistan. Yeah. Okay. Right. So what actually happened to the Buddha's body after entering his final nirvana is still under debate, and I think it is going to be it's likely to remain unknown. Nevertheless, knowledge about the Buddha's funeral largely depends on the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, or a Buddhist scripture in the Pali canon, narrating the great passing of the Buddha's last days. And the scripture has it that the body of the Buddha was cremated on a funeral pyre, all his physical body vanished, and only the bones and no ashes remained. So that's according to the scripture, that's what it said. And that his remains were divided into 8 portions between 8 kings. And you can see here the picture of 8 kings. One is missing there. This is just the Brahmin who divided the ashes, the bones. And each of the 8 kings subsequently built a stupa, which is a mound-like structure, for the bones they received. The urn, that earlier contained the bones was kept by the donor, which is the guy here, donor. The Brahmin who divided the Buddha's body remains into 8 portions. So the embers, or the woods from the funeral pyre, were given to the king who arrived late at the funeral. And these urn and embers were also given a stupa of their own. The last verse of Mahaparinibbana Sutta also mentioned 3 teeth as bodily relics of the Buddha. So one was kept by the 30 gods, another by Kalinga kings, and the last by the Nagas. And according to the scripture, hence, 2 types of the Buddha's relic were honored after the cremation of the Buddha's body. So bodily relics, that's the first type, which are which comprise of bones and teeth, and non-bodily relics, which comprise of urn and embers. Now we move to the next one. And so the term Kantara, used here to refer to an area of present-day northwestern Pakistan and southeastern Afghanistan, it includes the Peshawar Valley in Takasila, Manikiala, and the Swat Valley in Pakistan, and from Jalalabad Valley to Bamiyan, so Jalalabad Valley is, so that's Pakistan side, and that's Swat, and that's you know, like Jalalabad, and westward to Kabul, and Bamiyan was there, and further on is like Bactria is somewhere there. We were talking about Bactria earlier. So that's Gandhara. So, okay. So it is true here, through Gandhara, that Buddhism spread from India to Central Asia and then later on to the Far East. So it's kind of spread from there to there. That's Central Asia over there. So Gandhara was part of the Eurasian trade route and was ruled by a succession of foreign rulers. So, for example, the Iranian Achaemenids, the Greeks, the Indians, the Central Asian nomads. So it thus witnessed a lot of cultural dynamics politically, economically, and religiously. And one characteristic of Buddhist practices in Gandhara that appears to differ from those in India is that coins were routinely included in Buddhist relic deposits. I mean coins. I'm sorry, my pronunciation doesn't really help. Okay, so coins, evidences, can provide the dates of when Buddhist activities began in Gandhara. So as you can see here, the spread of Buddhism, I mean, the spread westwards of Buddhism, so from mid-2nd century BC, and then it spread there, yeah, to the west.
So did the coins have Buddhist sort of iconography, is it?
Some of them, yeah. But not many. Very small percentage. Very, very small, yeah. Okay, so coin evidence provides a chronological framework for the start of construction of Buddhist monuments in Gandhara. The coins were found from Buddhist sites as stray finds as well as stupa deposits. So coin evidences from this chart show the spread of Buddhism from India westward to Gandhara. The first two Buddhist monuments in Gandhara appear to have been built from the mid-2nd century BC onwards. And that happened in Swat area, which is here, and in Takasila area, which is there. So it's quite, I mean, about two centuries later, or one century after Ashoka.
Okay.
And then, right, so the Chinese pilgrims, two of the Chinese pilgrims, Fa Hien and Xuan Sang, of the 5th century and the 7th century AD, on visiting the northwest of the subcontinent during the early 5th century, 5th century AD, that's Fa Hien, he recorded bodily relics of the Buddha in the forms of a tooth and a flat bone of a skull. And 2 centuries later, another Chinese pilgrim, Xuan Sang, also mentioned the tooth relic in Jalalabad. But by his time, the tooth relic was no longer present, and only the stupa foundation was left to see. By the time of Xuan Sang, the Buddha's bodily relics seem to have had more forms than 2 centuries earlier. Yeah, from the tooth and the skull bone, the Buddha's bodily relics also have come to include an eyeball, which is in Hatta, hair and nail parings. Of these relics, the skull bone in Hatta seems to be the most valuable and popular. Fa Hien's description of the skull bone relics is that it is of a yellowish white color. Why that of Xuan Sang is, and that's in Xuan Sang's description of the skull bone, is he said it is 12 inches in circumference with distinct hair pores, yellowish white in color. So it's quite. And then both pilgrims recorded that the skull bone relic could also be seen by the public. Xuan Sang added that people could also use the skull bone relic to tell their fortunes, provided that they paid the right amount. So the cost is 1 gold coin or 1 gold piece to see the relic and 5 gold pieces to receive the fortune telling. Right. And there are, in Gandhara, we've got a lot of reliquaries. But the minority of reliquaries were inscribed. So there are 58 inscriptions on reliquaries and associated finds so far published, and 38 of them contain the word sharira or dhatu. 12 inscriptions record that the bodily relics belong to the historical Buddha, and it's used the word Shakyamuni. And in an example of inscribed Kantaran reliquary with the word Sharira is a reliquary from a stupa from Wadak in Afghanistan, and it's in the British Museum now. And it is not clear whether this reliquary contained bones or not, as the record only and the excavation record only stated that it contained sun-dry relics. So we don't know whether it actually contained bones or not. But we do know that it contained 66 copper coins of the Kushan king. However, excavation records show that about 33% of the total 75 stupas excavated in Afghanistan contain ashes and bones. So almost half of the stupas in Afghanistan contain bones and ashes. This leaves the other half in question as to whether or not there were bones inside. So far there is no definite evidence of Kandaran reliquary inscribed as containing the bodily relics of the Buddha as that actually contains bone fragments. The only such evidence is not a reliquary, but a copper sheet filed with a reliquary. So that's the copper sheet inscribed as containing the Buddha relics, as in copper bodily relics. Okay, and then all Kantaran reliquary inscriptions where the dedication of the relics is made always refer to the historical Buddha Shakyamuni and never to the previous Buddhas or other Buddhist venerables as in India. So in Kandara, you never, on the inscription, you never get the names of other Buddhas apart from the historical Buddha, which is the Shakyamuni. And that's it. And no other monks, no other venerables. Just the historical Buddha. So that's one thing that is unique in Kandara. So in Takisla, fragments of bone and ashes were generally placed inside small metal reliquaries, most of gold and silver. These small metal reliquaries were generally placed inside the larger reliquaries, generally made of stone. And inside the small metal reliquaries, bones and ashes were almost almost found alone, while precious stones, beads, and small gold ornaments were often found mingled in the larger stone reliquaries. Normally, when bones were found, they were found inside a very small gold or silver casket and never mixed with something else. And as mentioned before, the bones and ashes that were placed inside reliquaries were generally found inside relic chambers, a small chamber. A rare exception is bones and ashes from a stupa in Afghanistan, where the bones and ashes were placed inside a reliquary with one animal tooth, probably of a donkey, and one copper coin of a Kushan king. Now, some stupas contain ashes and bone without reliquaries, and so we wonder whether those ashes and bone were considered relics worthy of being venerated or not. So there are a number of Kandaran stupas that contain fragments of bone and ashes with no reliquaries. Such bones and ashes were deposited in four different ways according to their position in a stupa. Some were placed inside a relic chamber. Some were placed inside a core stupa mask outside the chamber. Some were placed inside the stupa mask, but as in outside the core stupa, but in the enlargement, the stupa enlargement, because some stupas were, or most of the stupas were enlarged at later stage. And then each time they enlarged, they put this reliquary as a mark of the enlargement. I don't know, we don't know, but maybe. Yeah, the bones and ashes that were not encased in reliquary and found outside relic chamber were almost found alone without being accompanied by precious items or coins. And it is unfortunate that the descriptions of bones found in this context were not made. Hadda in Afghanistan appears to be the area in Afghanistan that used the majority of examples of bone and ashes in stupa without other deposits. So they were found alone on their own without any accompanying objects, whereas in other places, when you find bones and ashes, normally they were accompanied by precious metal, precious objects. So these questions, the questions as to whom the bones in the uninscribed reliquaries and those deposited directly in the stupa must represent, and to what extent they were considered as relics still remain unanswered. So we don't know to whom these relics belong to. There's no label of these relics. We just know nothing about them. More than half of stupas in Afghanistan were recorded as not containing ashes or bones, while some stupas were reported as not containing anything at all. One reason behind this may have had something to do with the attitudes towards dead and dead bodies, because it lies in the crossroads of Asia. Kandhara must have been, to some extent, the place through which people of diverse ethnicity traversed and co-inhabited, among which were the Central Asian nomads and, well, let's say the Hindus, as in the Brahmanic people, as well as, of course, local people with local cults. One thing that these people may have had in common is that the Central Asian nomads and the Hindus may have had in common is that they tend not to preserve or keep the remains of the dead. I'm not sure, so maybe we can discuss this later. This is what I'm looking forward to discuss as well. So the Central Asian nomads in general, even nowadays, I mean, the Central Asian nomads, even nowadays, tend to expose the dead body to the sky, i.e. to be devoured by vultures. And it is the same practice as the Iranian or the Parsi Zoroastrianism manifested in... We don't know. The exposure of the body, the dead body, to the sky to be devoured by the vulture is the same practice as the Iranian or the Farsi Zoroastrianism manifested in the Parsi's Towers of Silence. For the Zoroastrians, this is a quote from somebody who's teaching Zoroastrianism in SOAS. I asked her, and then she said, that for Zoroastrianism, death is one of the products of evil, and the dead body of a good person is particularly polluting. The idea is that since during life, evil could not take possession of the good person, and it does so to a higher degree of the dead body of a good person. And that's why, you know, they believe that dead bodies equal polluting or pollution. Mm. The people with this belief or attitude may have had converted to Buddhism. I'm talking about the people who believe... who practice Zoroastrianism or Hindu during Kantaran period. So they may have had converted to Buddhism, but nevertheless maintain their attitude towards the dead and dead bodies and their mortuary practices. And equally, the co-inhabiting of such people, although not converted with the Buddhist Kantaris, may have forced or influenced the omission of ashes and bones in the stupas. There may be many more reasons for the absence of ashes and bone in stupas. For instance, such stupas may have been built to cover the spot where the cremation took place to mark the funeral event, etc. The cremated body remains and associated objects were, in this case, may have been removed to bury elsewhere. The attitude towards dead and dead bodies is thus only one of the other possible reasons that may be worth considering. And that's it. That's what I can say.
Okay. No, just a really perhaps ridiculous question. But
no, just ask anything.
No, it's really stupid.
I just know, yeah.
But how do you preserve an eyeball?
Actually, of course, I don't know myself. I myself don't know. That's why, because I don't believe at all in the idea of, you know, like eyeballs as rare.
Yeah.
But yeah, I actually I don't know how they preserve. Then you know, if you cremate it, if you cremate a body, then the eyeball will, you know, maybe one of the first thing to go. Mm. So I actually don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe mistranslation. I don't know.
Yeah, the ones that arrive.
Yeah.
But do you have any conception of how, like, originally the relics were, or maybe you do, I just totally missed it, they're worshipped, yeah? What is the theological or the religious concept behind keeping the relics?
To be honest, I don't know, because nothing is written about the religious concept behind the relics.
Mm.
And the only scripture that we know of, you know, relics is from the Mahaparinibbana Sutta.
Mm.
And then it doesn't really say it. Well, there's a debate going on whether the Buddha in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta prohibited the worship of the relic or not.
Mm.
So nobody really know what was going on, but I think it's based on the practice of the people during the period, like when you know, special person pass away, then they burn the body, like for example king or you know, like special monks or priests and they burn the body and then they keep something. But I don't know whether, like, nowadays in India, do they still, like, you know?
So they keep certain parts of the body before they burn the body.
Yeah, they keep. Oh no, not certain parts. I mean, they keep the whole body for people. As in, like, as far as I know, for example, for the king.
Okay.
Yeah, they keep the body for people to kind of, you know, pay respect, you know, like before burning it. So like kind of give the opportunity for people to come and kind of give respect to the body, and then afterwards, then they destroy the body. But
that would be like for a day or so, right? They would keep the body for a day or so.
I'm not sure, but in the scripture they said they kept the body for 1 week.
Okay.
Yeah, for 1 week, but they kept
to embalm it first. I mean, they'd have to be quick to embalm it.
Yeah, they kind of. I don't know exactly what happened, but
there must
it's
be
like
certain methods. That are
but the mod,
no, but
yeah, the mod.
In New Zealand, we had a Buddhist monk who didn't go into rigor mortis for 16 days.
Yeah.
Wow.
And doctors observed him, and they're like, "There's no way this can happen." So the thing is, it's Shakyamuni, you know.
So I think like in the scripture, it says that the body of the Buddha was placed in an oil, something like oil balm, I mean, and wrapped with cotton, and then put in an oil tank just to preserve.
Yeah.
And then after that,
it
was burned.
I mean,
they
say that in America today that the average person takes a lot longer to start decomposing because of the preservatives and additives.
Diet. Japanese people especially sometimes.
Yeah,
but it's got like huge. There's like huge sort of theological significance to how they're treating the the question I wanted to ask was obviously the way that these relics are treated over time has changed with developments in Buddhism, right?
It has changed. Yeah. Well, nowadays let's say in Thailand and we still worship the relics, you know, we consider like remains of the body of maybe special monks or things like that. But then we don't look at the relics as dead bodies, because it's kind of, you know, like special remains of the special dead or something like that. In Christianity, they also they also have the idea or have the practice of, you know, like keeping the bits of special dead or something like that. But in Hinduism, I think that do you consider dead body polluting as well or not?
As far as I'm aware,
certain
like key religious acharyas, they won't burn the body even. They put the body into samadhi, and that involves, you know, a big, it's like a burial, but it's in the posture. So they'll take the body and they'll put the body in the posture and then cover it with salt, so much salt, and then they don't see the body as dead. Actually, the guru has gone into eternal meditation.
So that's the idea, and
that the body is there. The body is there, and also the body is in the other world as well. You know, it's like a
interesting two cut. Yes. Yes, please.
I don't have anything about relics, but
No.
I did see last year I went to Singapore. And I went to the Buddha Tooth Relic Temple. Which I think
Singapore, you mean?
Singapore.
Yes, in Singapore. Okay. I think it might be Pure Land Buddhism. But very disappointingly the supposed tooth of the Buddha was a big chunk of crystal. With the explanation being that it was crystallized.
People believe that. They do believe it.
It may well be crystallized. Yeah. But what I was going to ask was, do you know whether in Gandharan times, in ancient times, crystallized relics were popular, or was that a sort of...
I guess not. I don't think so. Because, I don't know, let's say, but I don't think so. First of all, with the historical evidence, there's no written evidence mentioning anything about crystallization of the relic, so I don't think so. Maybe later, Asian kind of thing.
Are you doing comparative work? Is this your thesis?
This is part of my thesis, but I think I kind of concentrate on the roles of material or the role of object in terms of involvement of objects with people's life. So in the Buddhist in the relics worship context, so first you've got like dead body, and then afterwards then when certain people do not include dead bodies as the worship or ritual context, then they brought something else as a medium to worship. So that other object gained power instead of, bodies, because bodies, body has power already.
Would it take place with offerings the relics?
Yeah.
When people come and worship, would they give offerings or...
In that period, I give offering. There's no definite evidence. I have to say, but I guess so, because there's some stone relief depicting, like the worship of relics, and then like sorts of performances going on and flowers took part of the background, and then
so they would wash the relics. That wouldn't be. So it would be actively looked after.
I think so. In terms of dead bodies, I'm interested in why certain stupas do not contain relics or do not contain bits of bones at all, because the stupa is supposed to cover. I mean, the basic idea of the stupa, as far as I know, is to cover or to build on bits of human remains.
So they might not have been stolen or anything like that, and different...
That's indifferent, I know what you mean, but no.
With the stupas, were they erected, say, with the remains of the Buddha, are they all erected throughout Asia about the same time, or is this a different period? In Sri Lanka, they have the... I've been to where they have the collarbone. Is that the same sort of era, or...?
I think different periods. Different periods.
So the relics travel to the Central Asia, different period.
Yeah, for different periods for sure. Yeah.
And what is your theory? I mean, if you have, I'm sure you have multiple theories about why.
At the moment,
Why there aren't relics in some stupas?
I don't know. I still don't know. But I think because of the geography or the position of Gandhara is like crossroads of Asia, let's say, you know, it's it is in the middle of everywhere, for in that period.
Mm.
So you know, you've got southeast of Gandhara is India, like the whole continent of India, and then north of Gandhara is Central Asia, where all the commerce was going on, and then west of Gandhara you've got Iranian plateau. So and then so it's more or less like a melting pot. So who knows whether you know, people of diverse background, as in religious background, just thought, oh, I want to convert myself to Buddhism. I don't know. But then so they want to worship the Buddha in a certain form, but they still have their own attitudes towards the dead body as polluting or something.
Oh,
so they don't, so that they kind of maintain their attitudes. They kind of, convert themselves, they build the stupa, but they don't want to include anything morbid inside. I don't know, this is just one of the...
Oh, so that's why the comparative work is actually very... It's very helpful for understanding.
It could be...
What concepts people are bringing.
Yeah, it could be...
To the
And could be, and it could be also that, the dead bodies inside may not have anything to do with Buddhism, or the dead bodies inside or the bits of bones inside may have nothing to do with the Buddha himself, and maybe part special person in Gandhara, and then they just want to venerate or respect something like that. So yeah, that could be one of the reasons, but I don't know. Okay. You are welcome. Thank you.